Hong Kong as a human rights, geopolitical, and financial story today. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Hong Kong is the third most prominent financial capital, just behind London by one key ranking. Hong Kong's airport is normally the eighth busiest in the world, just after London's Heathrow and Chicago O'Hare. Today, Hong Kong authorities ordered that airport shut down as protesters overwhelmed the arrivals hall there. At the airport, protests have been largely but peaceful, although some protests over the weekend elsewhere had turned violent, with Beijing authorities suggesting seeing signs of, quote, terrorism, which some read as a hint about a possible crackdown. The protests began as a reaction to moves by Beijing to try some Hong Kong cases in mainland courts, but have since broadened into calls for more accountability by the government to the population. It is also a story being watched closely by financial market players today. On Monday, we consult economist Julia Coronado at Macro Policy Perspectives in New York.
The markets are waking up a bit nervous on the developments in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a major international financial hub that was shut down, and there is a real important litmus test for control of China of this important hub, and it dovetails into sort of the broader angst about the slowing Chinese economy, the slowing global economy, and how much all of this spills into disorderly political developments and the United States at the end of the day.
And speaking of Chinese economic slowing, we got some data today covering the month of July, and Chinese businesses and individuals did not take out as many loans as the forecasts were expecting. That must be trade war hidden in there.
It's starting to become conflated. China was already slowing for structural reasons, and credit has been the key engine of growth. So when credit growth slows, that's an important indicator. And now, you know, trade wars certainly don't help what was already a slowing economy. What we'll be looking for in the U.S. data is whether that is starting to show up in things like retail sales at the end of the week.
Julia Coronado at Macro Policy Perspectives. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Counting up Americans is an exquisitely complex logistical undertaking. The U.S. Census Bureau is rolling out its game plan, including plans to gather much more info online. Marketplace's Erica Barris takes a look at what that'll mean for door-to-door census takers and for those who have limited internet access.
19 million American households don't have easy access to the internet, according to Adi Tomer with the Brookings Institution.
It extends to every corner of the country.
Mostly in rural areas, among African Americans and Latinos and poor families. After households first get mail telling them to go online, door-to-door census takers will follow up. Kelly Percival with the Brennan Center at NYU Law says resources are in place for areas where undercounts already tend to happen.
They know they're going to need to print actual paper forms because people are less likely to have access to the internet.
More than 300 federal programs use census figures to determine how trillions of dollars are to be spent, says Andrew Reamer with George Washington University. Undercounts mean communities could lose out on money they need.
It will not go back to the state treasury or the federal treasury. It will go to other communities.
Communities that may not need the funds as much as those that are being undercounted. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Reading is good, even in this polarized age. That's not a controversial statement, right? So how is reading real books doing, as measured by how publishing companies did in the past quarter, spring to summer? Joining us is a Los Angeles Times critic at large, David Kippen. Mr. Kippen, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, David.
For those who think publishing and books, that it's all dead in this Instagram, Twitter, digital world, there are signs of life here, aren't there?
Oh, there are robust signs of life. Publishers seem to be enthusiastic, as they always do, but a little bit more credibly than usual. Book sales are up. So, yeah, until the sky falls tomorrow, people seem to be feeling their oats.
Books on political topics, given the times we live in, apparently doing very well.
Big surprise.
That's sort of always the case, but I mean, I'm talking to my own agent about a possible book, and she basically says, let's not come out with anything until 2027. The market is going to be clogged. But yes, there is a perception that this is all anybody wants to hear about or read about from now until Election Day.
So I have to ask a man of books, there's a red letter date on the publishing calendar coming out. It has something to do with the new Olive Kittredge book?
Yeah, Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout was a sensation several years ago and became no less of a sensation on television a little more recently. And there is another book featuring the same character called Olive Again that on the basis of the track record of the first one, one can only be optimistic about. But it's far from the only book worth getting excited about coming out for fall. I mean, John le Carré has a new novel out coming out called Agent Running in the Field, which I always look to from him to tell us, you know, where in the world I should be paying attention to. Margaret Atwood has a sequel coming out to The Handmaid's Tale. You may have heard about that. It's called The Testaments. It's somehow in between all the politics, there's going to be some promising fiction and nonfiction sneaking out.
Yeah, but also somehow in between all the digital noise that there are still books out there. That's what I'm hearing you're saying.
You are hearing me say it loud and clear and even a little bit more optimistically than I once might have. There's life in the old girl yet. I wouldn't still be publishing books. You wouldn't still be publishing the occasional book. There wouldn't be 10,000 of them on the shelves at Libros, Schmibros, and more all the time if there weren't cause for optimism. For crying out loud, somebody just paid a whole lot of money for Barnes & Noble and seems optimistic about turning it into the world's largest chain of independent bookstores. How's that for a business model?
Always good to talk to David Kippen, an LA Times critic at large, and also co-founder of a library in Los Angeles called Libros Schmibros. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it.
By the way, I'm not publishing a new book. I'm content to occasionally post to Instagram. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.